Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Princeton University Press Ideas Podcast, a joint production of Princeton University Press and the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, and today I'm speaking with Claudia de Rome, author of the book The Beauty of Falling, A Life in the Pursuit of Gravity. Claudia, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you. Hello there.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners a little something about yourself.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm Claudia de Rome. I'm a professor of theoretical physics. I currently live in London. I work at the Imperial College London. And so my day job is really to do research in trying to understand the fundamental building blocks of nature, the fundamental forces, and ideally understand deeper layers of nature. And I'm a cosmologist, actually, so that means that I sort of use observations from the universe, from the very beginning of the universe to the current universe, almost as a microscope to better understand fundamental physics. So I don't do the observations myself, I don't do the data analysis myself, but I use a lot of those data to come up with theoretical models that can explain what we observe and better understand the world around us.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a fascinating field, as you've described it in your book. And yet it's also one that you, as you explain it, you also are talking about your own life, which, I mean, you have a nice summary there of your professional life. But as you're explaining your book, you've led such a fascinating life. In addition to that, you have all these outside interests and these outside goals that you pursued that as you demonstrate so nicely, inform that. What led you to write a book about gravity, and what led you to adopt the approach that you did in writing it?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I think what led me to write a book about gravity is really sharing the ideas, sharing what we do with the general public and really inspire people. For me, it's such a passion, it's such an excitement. And then sometimes you talk to people, sometimes I'm on the bus with someone just sitting next to me and I start talking to them and they're like, oh my goodness, when is it going to stop? But really, it's for me, it's fascinating. And just sharing some of that in a way that is actually understandable so that people can see that there's really something out there that everybody can understand. I think perhaps one of my frustration sometimes is that in sharing some of those ideas, people have the impression that being a physicist, and particularly a theoretical physicist, is something quite exclusive, is something like, oh, you must be so clever. And the reality is very different. It's very creative. You need to come up with a lot of ideas and test those ideas, and collaboration, group working is extremely important. And so sharing some of those ideas out there with the public is, to me, that's why we'll be doing it at the end of the day. It's something for us as human, as opposed to for me in my little office by myself. So that was part of it. Perhaps it's a good question to understand why, what led me to it, and if my personal history is what, my personal life is what led me to studying gravity, or if it's because I had a passion for fundamental science and fundamental understanding of the world that I had the path that I had. And it's probably hard to disentangle both. One thing that was really interesting in writing the book is that I could realize it was almost a self-therapy. I could understand more and more really why I was drawn to it from the outset. And hopefully when people will read it, even though we have our own trajectory, which is different and diverse for everybody, but hopefully people can connect with that. They can connect the human aspect of what we're trying to do, the eagerness in understanding fundamental science, playing with gravity, playing with some of those concepts, and relate it to a much more personal level and hopefully be inspired a little bit by it.
I'd like to get a bit more into that in just a moment, but I was wondering if you could perhaps start us off by giving us sort of a brief primer as to sort of the evolution of our understanding of gravity over time, how, what it is that we've thought about gravity over the ages, and how we've gotten to what we can very crudely summarize as sort of the contemporary understanding of gravity before we get a bit more into some of the details you go into in your book.
Yeah, so absolutely. Yeah, so really understanding gravity, I think I was asking actually my daughter, she's 6 years old, the other day, and she was saying, oh, who's that guy that invented gravity? And then it was an apple that fell on his head, and then he invented gravity. And I guess that's the picture we have, so it's a good one. And Newton, I guess, really was one of the first that managed to model the concept of gravity in a mathematical framework or in a law theoretical framework, which is in reality not a million miles away from what we still do today. I think it was his ability to understanding that gravity, in the sense of how apple fall on the surface of the earth or on his head, and how planets orbiting around the sun in the solar system, for us human, they may seem like something quite different because the skills involved and the motion involved is quite different. And yet they are actually the same, different representation of exactly the same phenomenon. And this ability to abstractly link those concepts was very important. So for Newton, gravity is very much a force. And based on the work of Galileo already, they understood that something quite fundamental about gravity is the universal nature of it. And that is something that is almost a thread throughout the book, this universality. And perhaps to me, one of the points that I'm trying to address is how this notion of universality, and I'll explain what I mean by that, but was really important in how I connect with it, in how this is something very fundamental, that it doesn't distinguish between different objects, between different particles, between different being. You don't need to have an electric charge. You don't need to have a particular color. You don't need to have a particular size. Anything feels gravity. And on Earth, we may be a little bit biased against that because of the friction of the Earth. So we have the impression that if a feather falls or a hammer falls, we won't see us on the surface of the Earth falling at the same rate, but that's because of the friction of the Earth. And so it was really a phenomenal leap forward in our understanding by Galileo and then by Newton to realize that actually gravity affects everybody and everyone in roughly the same way. And it doesn't matter whether you're a feather or a hammer or an elephant or a bacteria or whatever you are, you will still experience gravity and you will still respond to gravity and affect gravity. And that today we know that is very much the case for many different reasons. But people may have seen that video of Neil Armstrong on the moon, where there's no atmosphere on the moon, so you're in the vacuum. There's no friction from the air. That's why the experiment is well done on the moon. And so he drops a feather and a hammer, and you see them really fall at exactly the same rate, and they reach the ground at the same time exactly. Illustrating the fact that gravity affects those two very different objects in exactly the same way. And now we understand that gravity is affected and affects even elements we have no palpable effect grasp of, like dark matter and dark energy, and it does affect light, and all of those concepts are related with one another with the idea of gravity. So Newton, what was remarkable in what he's done, understanding that gravity is a universal force, was to write down an equation, Newton's equation or Newton's square law of gravity, of universal gravitation, that tells you how the rate of acceleration based on the gravitational force that is acted on an object. And what was remarkable is that from this law, you could really describe the motion of object from the gravitational pull on Earth, or planets orbiting around the sun, or anything for that matter. And even his law today, we know it has to be extended, and I'll go through that, to the theory of general relativity. But in some limit, it's still precisely right. It's still the right thing to consider, and we can still use Newton's square law on how things are diluting over distances, how the gravitational strength is diluted over distances, in a variety of different setup, understanding, for instance, the evolution of the universe from a fraction of a second since the Big Bang all the way up to today. Mm-hmm. But already for Newton himself, and I would say for the community at the time, even though there was no observational evidence that at the time told you that there was any departure from Newton's square law, they already had some notion that something was funny with this phenomenon in the way he was describing it, because there was no notion of how the gravitational force was being mediated. It was just something instantaneous. So if you have two masses, you put two masses on a certain next to each other, and straight away they will feel gravitational pull to one another according to Newton's square law, according to his universal law. And that bothered him already, and it bothers us in understanding, because we like things to be communicated, and communication takes some time. If I look at you, I can't look at you right now, but if I were able to see you, there's a little bit of time that lapses between you being there and me being able to see you. And so if I think that there's a gravitational pull between two masses, you would think that this has to be communicated in a particular way, and that communication has to take some time. It can't be instantaneous. So already for Newton, he knew that something wasn't quite right without being able to quite put his finger on and quite understand in which regime his law would fail. It was much more of a conceptual realization that something else had to happen without really quite knowing where it had to differ. So that's Newton's description of gravity 4 centuries ago. And then since then, there's been a lot of observational realizations, both at the level of gravity. One of them was, for instance, better and better observations of the planets in the solar system, and better analysis of the orbits, and in particular, what we call the advance of the perihelion. So if you take the orbit, let me say, just of Mercury around the sun, is not an exact circle. It doesn't draw an exact circle. The orbit is sort of an ellipse. And the axis of this ellipse is twisted a little bit at every turn. And you can understand this, the shift of the orbit from the pole of the other objects in the solar system. And that was a very good way to describe what we call this advance of the perihelion, how the axis of the ellipses were being shifted at every orbit for all the other planets in the solar system. But for Mercury at the time, people were realizing that accounting for all the other planets and all the other things that are present in the solar system wasn't sufficient to explain the shift or the rotation of the axis of the ellipse of the orbit of Mercury around the sun. So that was a big puzzle, and people were postulating at the time the existence of other planets in the solar mm-hmm. system. And actually, that's something nowadays we'd think, we can't just postulate the existence of another planet in the solar system. That doesn't make sense. But at the time, this was quite normal, and that's actually how Pluto was being predicted by looking at the motion of the other planets in the solar system and say, well, actually, based on our observations, it looked like there must be some other masses being roughly there in the solar system, and then people were trying to look for it, and they were observing new planets. That's the way it was going at the time. There was very much a theoretical prediction based on observation, and then from those prediction, people were trying to look for new planets. So a new planet was being postulated in the solar system, which would have been somewhere to explain the motion of Mercury. And actually, the funny thing is, some people, Le Cabot actually thought that he'd observed it. And they observed it by looking at the motion of the planet right in front of the sun. And they thought that they had observed it. And they named that planet Vulcan. I think for most of you, Vulcan means something else. So already there, you know, it can't be right. But at the time, that's the thought that was going on in the community. Mm-hmm. So let me park that idea, because there was a while where people were really thinking, well, maybe there is another planet out there in the solar system that explain our small differences in the gravitational observation that we see in the solar system. But that's not the only thing that was happening. In the meantime, there's been a huge level of developments in understanding other phenomena extremely well, not only gravity, but the other forces of nature, in particularly electromagnetism. So probably all familiar with the electric force and the magnetic force, and something quite remarkable that happened for Maxwell at the end of the 20th century was realizing, at the end of the 19th century, towards the 1800s, was realizing that electricity and magnetism are not two distinct phenomenon again. They are the same phenomenon. And that is already hopefully starting to build some type of theme in the way people are thinking. Like a lot of the observation, a lot of the phenomenon, a lot of the forces that we observe in nature, we're starting to realize that for gravity, for instance, is not just how things fall on the surface of the Earth, the motion of planets in the solar system, or the motion of stars in the galaxy, and all of those things. They are just the same phenomenon, which is gravity. And then the same thing for electricity and magnetism. We're realizing that these are not two disconnected phenomenon. They're not two disconnected forces. They're actually realization of the same phenomenon, which we now call electromagnetism. And we actually now know that what someone may call the electric force, someone else may be calling that the magnetic force, because there's some sort of relative perspective on how we describe the electric force and the magnetic force, or the electric field and the magnetic field. And actually much of a muchness, the two things are roughly the same, different representation of the same phenomenon. And so Maxwell really made a leap forward in understanding that there's this unification of electricity and magnetism in a concept which we call electromagnetism. And something quite interesting he realized was that electric force and magnetic force, they are propagating by something which we call an electromagnetic field. And this electromagnetic field, he predicted that the speed of it had to be very close to that of light. And that's when he realized that actually light and electromagnetic waves in this electromagnetic field had to be the one and same thing. So that seems quite counterintuitive to us, to think that there is a magnetic force and then there's a notion of light, the light we receive from the sun, and those two things are actually very much related. Nowadays, we know that one way to create light, for instance, is to take two electric charges, for instance, two electrons, and shake them around. And that's actually what is happening in a bulb. If you shake them around, you accelerate them, you make them go back and forth, they would produce light. They would produce an electromagnetic field. They produce some disturbances in the electromagnetic field around them. And these disturbances, this wave of electromagnetism, is light. That's the way we perceive light, actually. And it's quite abstract, but it's very fundamental.
That's one of the things that I was really enjoying from your book is the interrelationships that you describe. You have a chapter you talk about the universality of gravity, and you also talk about the relationship between gravity and light. That was one of those things that I never really fully understood, but your explanation of it was, and when you were explaining, like, how did I not pick up on that sooner? But it was nicely done. In an interconnection that we don't necessarily think of superficially, which is, you know, this thing of light and how gravity can affect it. And yet, you know, there is, you know, it's not exactly a new phenomenon, but it's one of those ones where the more you think about it, it points to that interconnectivity that you're featuring.
That's right. Exactly. I think sometimes there's a big emphasis on saying gravity is unlike all the other forces of nature, is something quite different. And that is useful sometimes, but some other time, gravity is actually very, very similar to light. It's just two different realizations of some fundamental forces. but they are very similar in some sense. And in the same way that we see light, we observe light, we are sensitive to light, and light is actually the manifestation or the propagation of this electromagnetic field, which carries a force. This is what communicates the electromagnetic force between two charged particles, for instance. In that case, we really understand you have two electrons, and we probably are aware of the fact that if you have two electrons, they will repulse each other because they have opposite charge, and so they're going to repulse each other. That's from the electric force. But this notion that they want to go away from one another is being communicated by light. And that is not something we're probably very familiar with in our everyday life, but that is actually the case. There's a communication going on. Everything is being communicated, and everything is being some sort of connected with one another and connected and communicated through fundamental particles. And to me, that's very precious, because you see that we're not just an accident. Everything is connected to each other to some level. And gravity does that at an even more, much more powerful way, because it doesn't just communicate between electric charges, but it really connects with everything, absolutely everything. Everything is connected to gravity.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is actually one of the things, as I was reading your book, I thought was so funny about it, is that you talk about the universality of gravity. You talk about the connectivity of it all. And yet, I thought as I was reading your book that one way we could read your life is that you spend so much time defying shit. you learn how to fly. You train and pursue going into space. And while you're never going to escape gravity, you're certainly doing your best to try to.
Yeah, it's a love-hate relationship. Yeah, I do feel a little bit like, and let me say something a little bit different there. But sometimes when people really challenge you, you know that you have, it's actually flattering, because you know you have reached a level of a relationship with that person when they feel comfortable challenging you. There's a little bit of that. And, there's definitely this, it's a passion there, but also you can't prevent the teasing gravity a little bit and trying to push it. And you know, if you drop an object, it will fall. But still, you can't prevent from doing it.
But what I enjoyed from the way you describe your book, because I mean, that was something that was just an impression I took from it, is how you use those experiences, that time to explore gravity, and how through that process you illustrate these things, how these are maybe not things we think about in the everyday, but are very much part of our everyday.
Yes, I think for me, it's very part of doing research, but also all of these feelings and all of this way we connect with gravity, or we connect with our understanding of the world. At the end of the day, it's very personal. And I think there is an aspect of creativity there. It's not just formula on a blackboard, which are abstract and are just meant to represent something you put a number in and make prediction. It's actually something very human in the way we embrace the world around us and try to model it. We try to represent it in a way that actually makes sense to us. And so all of the analogies, all of the metaphors, or even for me, the way I understand gravity, of course, there is a level of abstractness there, and a level of following some rules, following some of the guidelines that are set there. But there's also a much more personal aspect in how to connect that with something that makes sense to me, that I can relate on a much more personal, on a much more human level. And I think it's important never to give that up, because part of it is where your intuition comes in. The way we do research is still, we need some level of creativity to understand what will come next. And so we need to engage a little bit with more how we, to some extent, how we feel about it. I think one of the reasons I'm so excited about gravity and so many other people are, is because we know that deep down gravity does fail. Even so, we haven't even gone to sorry, I haven't even reached Einstein's theory of general relativity, but do you reconnect this notion of light and the universality in the speed of light and the universality in how gravity affects us? Einstein understood how to go to the unification, a further unification of space and time through special relativity, and then a further unification with gravity, which allows us to understand through general relativity how gravity is the manifestation of the curvature of space-time around ourselves. And all of this is an encompassing phenomenon. But even though we have this beautiful description that we have no observational evidence at the moment that it should be anything different as compared to what we observe, we still know that it fails. We still know that it predicts at some point, let me just say, some nonsense. General relativity, at some point, we know that it fails. It predicts some measurable quantities, which are infinite, what we call singularities, for instance, at the center of a black hole or the Big Bang. So we know that there is a point where we can't use Einstein's theory of general relativity anymore to predict what is happening. Something else has to come in. And I think the fact that it tells us from the outset something else has to come in, it tells us from the outset that the theory does fail at some point, it's sort of one of the reasons as well. There's a big eagerness to play with it, to understand it a little bit better, and to challenge it a little bit. That's very much where I come from.
Wondering if you could maybe then take us into the work that you're doing that you describe it in the final part of your book. Because reading your book was the first time I'd heard of this theory of massive gravity. And although I had heard of gravitons in the past, I was wondering if you could briefly explain what it is you're doing there and you know, how it fits with the, you know, gravity or how it will advance our understanding of gravity as it currently exists.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's as well one of the places where we try somehow to challenge gravity a little bit, to tease it a little bit, almost in a playful way. But let me just say that there are reasons why we want to do that. It's not just that I'm bored with my life and it's my new hobby. But so we have, as I mentioned, from one perspective, we already know that some of the predictions of Einstein's theory of general relativity at in regions of space-time where the curvature is very large, they break down. We can't use them anymore. We know that. Now, this is not exactly why I'm studying massive gravity, and I'll explain what I mean by massive gravity. But there are other aspects in our understanding of gravity and our understanding of how it relates with the other phenomena in nature, with the other particles that exist in nature, where things are confusing, to say the least. One of the things that we know, we understand general relativity very well on most of the scales, but we also know that this is not everything. We know that the realm of quantum field theory, which let me just say, it's the realm of the fundamental particles. So we know, for instance, a photon is the particle that propagates light or that propagates the electromagnetic field. And we talked about other particles like the electron. And you mentioned the particle of the graviton. So the graviton is the equivalent to the photon, is the particle that mediates the gravitational force, just like the photon mediates the electromagnetic force, the graviton mediates the gravitational force. And there's a direct analogy between the two there. But those are not the only particles in nature. They are the electrons. We know, for instance, about the Higgs particle, which you may have heard of, is responsible for giving a mass to some of the other fundamental particles in nature, like the W and the Z boson, for instance. And actually, the W and Z boson, let me just say in 2 seconds that those are also particles that do mediate a force. They mediate a force which is, you may not be familiar with it. Do you know what force they mediate, actually?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
I asked the question on purpose because we typically don't know necessarily about them and what they do, because the force they mediate is a very weak force. It's only present in the atomic structure, and beyond that, we don't never really feel it. It's weak. We call it actually the weak force. As the reason we call it the weak force is because it's weak. And the reason it's weak is because the W and the Z boson have a mass, in the sense that they are particles with an inertial mass. And the reason they have an inertial mass is precisely because the Higgs has given them a mass. The Higgs asks if you want some sort of glue that prevents them to having too much dynamics of their own to some extent. So that means that the force that they mediate is a much weaker force as compared to electromagnetism, which is propagated by the photon, which is a massless particle, a particle with no mass. So this is just a little bit of background of particle physics, but it is something that I'm not just coming up like that on top of my head with this story. It's something which is very, very well understood. This is all the realm of particle physics, and there's huge particle accelerators or particle colliders that test fundamental physics and the fundamental constituents of matters, the fundamental particles, to a very, very good accuracy. And so, for instance, the Higgs was discovered at CERN, at the Large Hadron Collider, a decade ago. Now, we know from the particle physics realm, and we know, for instance, from the Higgs mechanism, that what we call the vacuum, what I mean by that is if you were able to take a room and remove anything from it, anything concrete from it, all the particles, any light, anything from it, then it won't be completely empty. It will still carry energy, which is in some sense, the soul of all the virtual particles. It's a sea of virtual particles that is present everywhere, absolutely everywhere in the universe. And that if you want out, it is, for instance, the Higgs is what allows you, through its energy being present everywhere in the universe, is what allows other particles to have a mass. So it's not something which is just present on Earth or in the solar system or in the galaxy. It's present everywhere, constantly everywhere in the universe. There's some energy density of all of the, in the vacuum of all the particles that we know exist. But this vacuum energy, this energy from all the particles, all the known particles, they should have an effect. They should have a gravitational effect. And unlike if you have a localized mass, like the sun, we understand how it curved the structure of space-time around itself in a local way. It's just around itself that it curves space-time. But if you are very far away from it, you wouldn't feel that curvature. So you don't feel too much the effect of the sun if you're very far away. Okay, so we understand how, if we have, for instance, the mass of the sun, it will affect the curvature of space-time around itself. And that's something quite local. If you're very far away on the other side of the universe, you're not going to be too sensitive to that curvature because it's a local effect. The sun is just localized somewhere. But when we're thinking about this energy, this vacuum energy, this omnipresence of all the particles being present in the universe, or the, at the very least, the contribution to the vacuum energy, or the Higgs field, if you want, then it's not something which is just at one point in space, at one point in space-time. It's everywhere in the universe, everywhere and all the time, which means you can be in the galaxy if you want to, and you will have this Higgs C, you have this energy density being present there, but you can also be in an intergalactic void where there would be nothing else at all there whatsoever. There wouldn't be any dark matter there being present, and yet there would be some level of energy being present because of the soul of all the particles that we know exist. And so the effect of this, what we call vacuum energy from particle physics, should affect the universe in quite a different way than a picture we have in mind of this localized curvature. And the way it does it is actually something that Einstein himself thought about when he came up with this theory of Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is a constant, a cosmological constant, because it's everywhere in cosmology. It's everywhere in space and time. It's a constant. So the vacuum energy of particle physics actually do play the role of the cosmological constant that Einstein himself thought could be added into his theory. So this, in some sense, is all very good. It's all a very good sign. Now, this constant, this cosmological constant, would lead to not only an expansion of the universe, but actually an accelerated expansion of the universe. So if you think of the space between any two stars in the universe, the space in between gets stretched. And not only you have at least an expansion of the universe, but it gets stretched faster and faster. So the expansion of the universe is accelerated. And that is actually something that is a result, can be a result of the vacuum energy, is definitely a result of Einstein's cosmological constant. And this accelerated expansion of the universe is something that we do observe. This is one of the biggest discovery and actually led to the Nobel Prize in 2011 for the discovery from supernovae that the expansion of the universe seems to be accelerating. That's what observations tell us. So in theory, all of this seems to be completely consistent with one another in the sense that we have particle physics on one side that tells us that we should have some sort of energy being present even in the vacuum from the particles that we do know, for instance, the Higgs C, and that should give an energy to the vacuum. And we also know that this would look like a cosmological constant that Einstein himself had originally introduced, not originally, but had introduced in his equations. And at the same time, we know that this accelerated expansion would lead, this vacuum energy would lead to an accelerated of the universe, expansion of the universe, which is exactly what we observe. So all of this seems completely consistent with one another, with a small little caveat that actually when we try to put the numbers in together, you get complete nonsense. Actually, if you were really to take into account the vacuum energy from the particles that we know, they will lead to an accelerated expansion of the universe, which will be way, 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 way too fast, really way too fast, by many, many orders of magnitude too fast. And this is not something which is in tension with observations. It's something which would be unviable for us. The expansion of the universe, if we were really to take into account, as we think in particle physics, the vacuum energy from the particles we know, it would lead to an accelerated expansion of the universe that would mean we wouldn't even be able to see the moon. The moon would be receding away from us at speed faster than the speed of light. And so clearly that cannot be the case. I accept a lot of things. I can accept all sorts of different experiments that would take the age of the universe to implement. That's fine by me. But there's one thing I know is that I can't see the moon. Well, I may not be a big of an observer, but I can see the moon. And so I'll draw the line there. That definitely is not consistent with our observations. And so the model of massive gravity, finally I'm getting to it, the model of massive gravity that we came up with is exactly trying to twig Einstein's theory of general relativity every so subtly in such a way that this huge amount of vacuum energy that is present, if we were to believe the predictions from particle physics, they have an impact on the accelerated expansion of the universe. They have a gravitational impact, which is much weaker than what we would have expected from Einstein's theory of general relativity. And so we want to tweak Einstein's theory of general relativity in a way that it becomes weaker at some point. It becomes weaker when we're dealing with phenomena which are on the size of the universe. We don't want to affect it on the size of the solar system, because we understand gravity in the solar system extremely well. We don't want to affect it on the scale of the galaxies, because there as well, we understand things very well. We don't want to affect it on most of the system that we understand very well. But on cosmological scales, that's where we get nonsense. And so that's where we would like to make gravity weaker on those large scales. And this is why I spent so much time talking about the particles before, and the notion that some particles can mediate a force which is weak. if you there wasn't no concept that I mentioned them at that time, it seemed like a little bit of a detour, but it's actually coming all back together. The W and the Z boson, they mediate a weak force, or a force which is weaker as compared to what they could have done, because the particles that they are have a mass, they carry a mass. And so what we can do is something which is actually quite natural. We can investigate whether the graviton, the particle carrier of the gravitational mass, could itself has a very small mass, a really tiny mass, in such a way that the force of gravity that it carries on very large scale would be weaker as compared to what the predictions from Einstein's theory of general relativity would be. So in Einstein's theory of general relativity, there is already a fundamental particle, which is the graviton, or we can think of it like that, maybe not according to Einstein per se, but if we complement it with quantum field theory, we can think of it as being mediated by a massless particle, the graviton. And that would mean that the vacuum energy should have a dramatic effect on the evolution of the universe. If, on the other hand, we allow for the force of gravity to be every so weaker on very large distances, on cosmological distances, for the graviton to have a little mass, then the force of gravity would be weaker and the effect of the vacuum energy would be weaker, and it wouldn't lead to an accelerated expansion of the universe as strong as what we would otherwise have anticipated according to Einstein's theory of general relativity. So what we're trying is to tweak Einstein's theory of general relativity just slightly in such a way that we can understand how to reconcile it with particle physics and with our observations of the accelerated expansion of the universe. So in a nutshell, that's the theory of massive gravity. It's a very long-winded answer, but massive gravity is quite the opposite of being massive in a sense. It's gigantic gravity is the opposite. It's making gravity being a bit more subtle on large distances. On our everyday life, it would be just the same. But if you think of it on cosmological scales, it would be weaker because the particle that mediate it has a mass, hence massive gravity.
I mean, this degree of detail, I mean, it's fascinating theory. And you know, it's definitely something I'm going to, I look forward to reading. You do a great job explaining your book. But I also want to get a sense or to give our listeners a sense as to how you connect this, you know, this gravity, our understanding of it, its role in the world, with some of the events in your own life, because that's the essence of your book. It's not just gravitational theory. It's not just the history of gravity. It's not the role of gravity as a force in the universe, but it's also something where you talk about how how it informs your understanding of your own life, or how you draw insights from your life that help you to better understand how gravity works. I was wondering if you could perhaps you give us an example as to how you do that in your book, because it really is one of the things that makes your book such a great reading experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, that was really what made it quite fun to write, because it was my personal perspective on gravity. I think one thing is that it is really such a fun topic to explore. And so not everything has been as positive in my life as it could be. I mean, things have been very positive, but challenges are present no matter who you are, no matter what you do. Challenges will always be present. But I think the fun part of it and taking the positive side of every experience is definitely something I like to reflect on, because it seems from the outside as something quite challenging, but it is so much fun. I hope you will see some of that. But perhaps an element which for me, was important in understanding how my own life does relate with gravity or how we understand gravity is the fact that I've been traveling in my life quite a lot already as a child from one place to another. And so from at every stage, it was much clearer to me that you had to connect points in space and time with one another. By themselves, they will seem to be completely disconnected, to be abstract, but it's in the way you decide to bridge between one experience in your life to another, to the next, etc., that makes you who you are. And actually, that's how your life does come to life, literally. And And it's in adapting with the complexity of the situations in which you are. Things are not never completely straightforward from the outside, but it's in adapting for this complexity that makes your life path so precious and so unique and actually really worth exploring and sharing. And that aspect, I think, is very similar to how we are experiencing gravity. Gravity, according to Einstein's theory of general relativity, you can think of it as the thread connecting different points in space and time together. There's not such a thing as gravity at any single point because there's no notion of curvature per se at any single point. The very notion of curvature is intrinsic on how you connect points to one another. You can think of this as if you compare the curvature of space-time with the curvature of the surface of the Earth. If you think of how you know that the Earth is round and not flat, is by comparing what you see on different points on the surface of the Earth. So it's very important to communicate and connect between different points. That's how curvature comes to life and emerges, and that's how gravity comes to life. It is not something which has any meaning at any given point. It's in how you want to bridge from one point to another that you do experience curvature and you do experience the notion of gravity. And so that's why if you're thinking of what it means to embracing curvature and just letting yourself go, if you think of the notion of free falling, embracing this curvature and just getting rid of any other obstruction, any other distraction, this is what you would consider being a straight line. And yet, if you think of the planets orbiting the sun, they are following a straight line according to them. They're just going straight in a straight line. That's the best way they can bridge between the different points for them, adapting for the curvature in which they live in. From the outside, the trajectory they follow may seem very complicated. It may seem like it's nothing like a straight line at all, but actually that's the best they can do given the situation in which they are. And I feel most of the time that's how I feel, given the situation in which I am. I'm doing the best with it and just following a straight line and just embracing the situation in which you are. And it may look like funny from the outside, but it is actually in how you are able to connect those different points and letting yourself embracing this environment in which you find yourself that you find the preciousness in every single life trajectory. And maybe for me, this is actually very important because if you think of how different people embrace their careers on how they go from one point to another, maybe it may seem strange from an external perspective, but most of the time, it's because they are in a particular situation and they do the best for the given situation in which they are that makes their trajectory so beautiful to follow. And so embracing that level is very important.
We appreciate the time you've taken to speak with us. But before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things I'm quite excited to understand now is in knowing that there are things which is beyond our current realm of understanding. For instance, I said that we know that Einstein's theory of general relativity does break down at some point near the singularities at the center of black holes or at the very beginning of the universe. We know something else has to come up, but we don't know exactly what it is. And different people may come up with different theories, and they may have different realizations. But what I'm trying to work on at the moment is while remaining quite agnostic on what is the precise realization of nature in this situation, what would be the implication for our everyday physics? And that can have some implications for the type of things we may be looking at or how different things manifest themselves in our everyday life. And that can have some consequences for looking for physics beyond the standard model in particle colliders. It can have some implication for looking at cosmology and signatures of dark matter, for instance, or the features. or it can have some implication for how we think of gravitational waves and the evolution of gravitational waves through space-time. But I don't want to be too restrictive in the kind of model that may come up beyond the realm of accessibility. And yet I like that consistency of physics in a realm where I know I'll never be able to access still gives us some insight for the type of realization that we would have expected from our everyday physics point of view.
Well, it sounds like an interesting way of thinking about things. I wish you the best of luck with it.
Thank you. Thanks.
Claudia, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Pleasure.